Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The COVID-19 death toll in the U.S. is nearing 80,000. In South Dakota, as many states hope to reopen for increasing commerce, South Dakota continues on a path of social distancing, following current CDC guidelines to slow the spread of the contagion and preparing for a predicted surge in hospitalizations. Since the first confirmed cases in the state, In the Moment has been bringing you weekly updates from statewide leaders in the healthcare industry, asking about what we know this week that we didn't know before about a new virus and how it impacts our lives. Today, we're joined by Dr. Wendell Hoffman. He's an infectious disease doctor with Sanford Health. Dr. Hoffman, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be with you, Lori. Thank you for having me.
Let's start out with some of the things that we are still learning about this virus. What are you seeing that we maybe didn't even fully understand a week or two ago?
So just before that, if I might, I just want to highlight the fact that we are still in Nurses Week officially, highlighting, you know, the amazing work and pioneering work of Florence Nightingale, once called the Lady with the Lamp, and who really brought professional nursing into the modern era. Florence Nightingale was not only famous for separating clean from dirty and doing basic infection control practices in that Crimean conflict, but she also pioneered data visualization, which is really amazing if you look at some of her initial graphs. But I just want to say, and I'm sorry to take this a little bit, but you know, physicians often get the glory, but it's nurses who deserve the praise. So with that said, I kudos to all of our nurses around the state, literally, who are now caring for dozens of COVID patients in our hospitals.
Yes. Thank you so much to those nurses, and who are doing so in a story where, you know, we've heard in cities and hospitals across the nation of the loss of life among nurses, which I'm not sure if it's unprecedented right now or what those total numbers are, but certainly there are some very high-profile cases of nurses who have died doing that kind of care. The stakes have never been higher, right?
The stakes are very high. I am pleased, however, to say that with good mitigation strategies, particularly in our hospitals, we're taking that risk down to a very, very low range. The initial reports of 30% of healthcare workers from China coming down with COVID really reflected a time where either no personal protective equipment was used or it was poorly used. So now, with what we're doing, those numbers are markedly decreased, and I'm just very pleased for that, because our goal, of course, is to protect our healthcare workers in addition to our communities.
All right, let's talk about some of that new research. What do we know about transmission? Let's start there, that we didn't know before.
So I think what's so interesting to me is this whole idea of what's called the turbulent gas cloud. Sounds kind of funny. But, you know, up until more recently, we used to sort of in a binary fashion describe respiratory droplets in terms of large versus small. What is clear from the more recent work is that the air that we exhale, sneezes, coughs, not only consist of these droplets, but are also made up of what they call a multi-phase turbulent gas cloud. In other words, a puff, a cloud that goes out. And with significant power based upon like a strong sneeze or a cough, some of these models are suggesting that you can project these kinds of secretions out 26 to 27 feet. Now, when you couple that with the potential that aerosolization may be, although we think it's a lesser mode of contagion, when you couple it with that, one can begin to see why this virus is so contagious. But it's contagious, I would qualify that in the right setting. So closed spaces, indoor spaces, larger rather than smaller gatherings, prolonged time, and then, you know, no or poor mitigation strategies performed within those spaces account, I think, for the majority of why this virus is being transmitted. And if you'd like, I can cite three kind of major papers that have come out that I think prove that point.
I think so. Let's help people really understand this. Because so much of what happens in the days ahead is, you know, business owners are making decisions, not just based on how do they stay open and keep workers, but like they don't want their customers to get sick. They don't want to be a center of the next, you know, cluster or hotspot. And we're all making decisions about where we go and why we go there and what we do when we're there. So let's go a little deeper into some of that research, please.
Yeah. So I think before I go there, I just want to frame it up by saying that, you know, we've been talking, again, we love to use binaries, right? So we've been talking about population health versus the economy. In fact, what we're talking about is health versus health, because think about it. We have a public health crisis, which is generating as a secondary threat a population health crisis. And so both involve the health of our nation. And we are delaying things like childhood immunization, biopsies, cancer evaluations, and on and on and on in those patients who have the famous underlying medical conditions who themselves are marching forward. So I think we need to move away from this more simplistic notion of safety versus money. I think that's absurd because it just doesn't comport with what we're seeing. In fact, there is a science to unemployment, right? And so I think there's, just like there's a science to the COVID, there's also a science to what we're having to do initially here anyway to control the to SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19. Now, in that regard, there are three kind of studies that really intrigue me. One is in a pre-printed version, and I sent all of these to you, Lori, to post hopefully on your website so people can look a little bit further. But the Chinese looked into 318 outbreaks earlier on in their epidemic. And what they found, very interestingly, when they looked at what they called an outbreak, that 80% of these outbreaks were occurring in the home, involving anywhere between 3 to 5 cases. The second piece that has also appeared, again, in a pre-printed version, which means that it hasn't been fully vetted through peer review, is an author from the Massachusetts Woods Hole Group, who has evaluated the impact of strict lockdown procedures. And what he has reported is that it would appear that in countries like France, Italy, Great Britain, and Spain, the strict lockdown procedures really had no more benefit than lesser measures sort of adopted by countries like the Netherlands and Germany. So, and then thirdly, Governor Cuomo in New York State said, I think it was on May 7th, that in his briefing that based upon a 1,200 or so person interview asking people who had come into the New York hospitals and basically asked the question, from what context did you come out of? Fully 66% said they came out of their home where they were practicing the lockdown procedure. So I think what we're seeing is a strategy going forward that maybe the strict lockdowns are not as good as what we might have thought. Now, that's not to blame anybody. It just reflects that we're dealing with emerging science, not settled science. And so from those three examples, I think we are seeing that even the home is a risk place, and it's a place where people should be exercising some of these measures: good hand hygiene, environmental cleaning, maintaining some social distancing even within the home to as much as you can, and then with the use of masks, particularly when you're out and about.
I want to go back to something that you said before we talked about those studies, and that is about how far things in these turbulent gas clouds can be spread. And when you're setting up a business or you're setting up a place where people are going to enter and exit it, what are some of the things, knowing what we know now, that are really mandatory? And when we're making decisions about where we go and what we're looking for, what are we looking for?
So I think it's interesting that you use the word mandatory. I mean, I visited four different establishments, which if I told you the brands of these, you'd immediately recognize them over the last number of days. Two out of the four, the staff were wearing masks. The other two didn't. And what I was told when I asked the manager at this one location where I went in to pick up a product, she said to me, well, this is not mandated. So I think if we're going to open up, I want to say to the small business community, you need to wear masks, not in substitution of the other things, but in addition to. And because of the fact of this kind of gas cloud kind of idea that these secretions can go out even beyond the arbitrary 6 feet. There's nothing necessarily magic about 6 feet. In fact, that came from the knowledge, again, to go back to the large and small droplet nuclei. It goes back to the idea that large droplets kind of go out 3 to 6 feet, and then they kind of fall to the ground. Well, the gas cloud hypothesis says, no, that may not be completely true. It actually probably goes out much further than that, particularly with forceful talking, with sneezing, with coughing, and also the longer that you're in these spaces. So I want to say to the public, I want to say to the small business owners, you need to have your staff wear masks. Now, masks are not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but if your viewership will go to that article and the embedded video, which demonstrates this turbulent gas cloud, I don't think you need any other proof that masks are at least going to help. The problem is that people demand perfection. Well, they're not perfect, but they do help, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to contain as much as we can that cloud of material that comes out of all of us with all of these breathing and talking and coughing and sneezing exercises.
What kind of masks matter? Because with the mask debate, which is quickly turning into a social debate about who you're scaring by wearing a mask or what they're really good for and what they're not, a lot of people are posting things on social media that say, hey, as soon as you touch that mask, even if it's an N95 mask, it's contaminated and it makes no difference anymore. So let's talk about proper wearing of a mask and what kinds of facial coverings are the most effective and what kinds are just, you know, will do and are better than nothing.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there are some good points to be made about the proper use of masking. Yes, you shouldn't be touching the front of the mask. You should properly take it off from the ears and then carefully lay it down on a clean surface. And then when you pick it up, same thing, you don't touch the front of the mask. But it is an issue, but the issue of the mask itself needs to be highlighted. There have been a lot of studies on the effectiveness of different materials and their effectiveness in screening out potential pathogens. And I want to say fundamentally, what a mask does doesn't necessarily protect you. It doesn't necessarily protect me from you, Lori, but it does some protection of protecting you from me. And so it is in some ways a responsible, maybe a little bit of a selfless act, because you're trying not to put forward respiratory secretions from yourself, and that is a benefit to overall public health. There are better masks and poorer masks. There's no question about it. And I did send you another article out of the University of Chicago where they actually tested what kinds of materials would best filter things out. And what they found was if you put two layers of, you know, high-quality cotton, high-weave cotton, as they say, and you add two more layers of a fabric like silk or chiffon, you can actually begin to approach an N95 efficiency, assuming that you've got a pretty tight fit. So, I mean, I think there are better masks. So, again, the operative word needs to be better, not perfect. And so can we get better as we go forward? Can we make better masks? Yes, we can. And we have a little bit of science now to give us some background in that regard. And there are a lot of wonderful mask makers out there. It is so encouraging to see this effort in what arguably is a war against this horrible virus.
Yeah. You mentioned air circulation and closed indoor, you know, areas. So let's talk about restaurants. And when you go to a restaurant, if you go with a small group of people, the tables are, you know, 6 feet, 10 feet apart. You can't wear a mask when you eat, but let's say your wait staff does wear a mask when they serve you. All these things are moving in the right direction. What about how big that facility is and what kind of air filtration system they have? Or, as the days get warmer, air conditioning. What do we know about some of the risks of that?
So, yeah, those are all really, really great questions. I'm not sure we have a solid data to back up the kinds of environments that exist in some of these settings and restaurants. Most of these buildings go by standards. Standards of ventilation in general. I think, not all buildings certainly are going to have HEPA filters, and we certainly are not going to wear HEPA filters as we're eating, as you point out. But it doesn't have to be perfect to make an impact. And so, in a restaurant, as restaurants open up, I think, first and foremost, restaurants need to track what's happening in our region. If we're having an uptick in cases, that needs to be noted. If we're continuing to come down the slope, it does at least suggest that the infection burden out there in the community is lessening over time. And so businesses can take that into consideration and begin to then try to conceive of how they can best implement these kinds of strategies. And so when you can wear a mask, when you can stay at least 6 feet apart, always wash your hands. And, of course, what they're doing really well on that I've observed is aggressive environmental cleaning, which I think is really important.
Yeah, and let's go back to that, because what you said earlier is this home environment, with the study that said in China, out of 318 outbreaks, 80% of them occurred at home, and the research coming out of New York saying how many people, came from a home environment. I know I personally have gotten a little sloppy about environmental cleaning the more I have stayed home and thought, well, if we're not going anywhere, it's not a problem. But let's just go back to how people should clean. What are the best ways to clean your house to give that good environmental cleaning in a home environment? Because I don't want to make anybody panic here. I just want to give them the tools and what they can do. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And, so there are other studies that said that, again, coming from China, that the attack rate within a household was about 15%. So the studies are kind of all over the place, and so you have to factor a lot of things in. I mean, this is why the World Health Organization, by the reporting from the Washington Post, has said that we're now tracking 14,600 articles on this whole subject. So it's more than drinking from a fire hose anymore. It's now kind of a wash in a waterfall. And so I think with that in mind, though, what are some things that are reasonable? In the home, I'll just tell you what my wife and I do. So, we try to maintain some social distancing. We try as much as I can. I try to stay 6 feet away from her, and she does the same with me because she's also going out into the community. We wash our hands frequently in the home, and we do some focused environmental cleaning on our countertops, and in particular, and then periodically cleaning our toileting areas. So I don't think you have to go overboard to do a good job to be a part of what has become a famous word now, and that is mitigation. And so I think we all can do some of these things, and common, everyday household cleaners more than blow this virus out of the water. These are fragile RNA polymerase viruses. and I'm sorry, RNA envelope viruses, and they are they're very susceptible even to normal drying. So, for instance, when I come home, I will, and I don't, I'm not suggesting this for everybody, but in our context, I just hang my clothes in a different part of the house, and I just let them kind of desiccate, dry out, because the virus, mm-hmm. over time, it particularly on non-porous surfaces, probably disintegrates fairly quickly. On non-porous surfaces. On porous surfaces, I think the things like we've read about plastic and steel and cardboard, I think the cleaning action is maybe more important. But so I think those common cleaners do an excellent job in cleaning those surfaces and make your household safer.
Yeah. Dr. Hoffman, you have been great throughout this whole journey, and we continue to have look forward to more conversations with you as well, because this is a story that continues to change. And for listeners, I'm sorry you have to stay vigilant. I'm sorry for all of us that we have to do these sorts of things, but we are all in it together and trying to help out not only the nurses of Nurses Week to keep from being overwhelmed by our illnesses, but to help the people that we love in our families and beyond. Dr. Hoffman with Sanford Health, thank you so much for your insight. We will post links to those research studies on our website after the program at listen.sdpb.org. Thanks, Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you for having me, Laura.